I've changed my topic a little bit to focus on the financial crisis because that was in the description of the series of panels that Yuri put together. And thank you very much, Yuri, for organizing these panels and inviting me to speak. The title is Short-Termism, Managerial Myopia in the Financial Crisis. The financial crisis was preceded by a period of various firms seeking short-term profit, regardless of long-term consequences. Myopic behavior was engaged in by numerous market players, such as mortgage originators, lenders, underwriters of subprime mortgage-backed securities, credit default swap sellers, rating agencies, and institutional investors. Contrary to the efficient market hypothesis, market prices of securities failed to reflect underlying risks in the wake of a massive decline in lending, underwriting, and rating standards, and over-reliance on the risk reduction capabilities of derivative transactions, and models that failed to account for low-frequency economic shocks. In July of 2007, the CEO of Citibank, Charles Prince, captured the motivation for short-termism. While acknowledging that the party would end at some point, he claimed that as long as the music is playing, you've just got to get up and dance. For some time, the stock market and credit markets were fooled by this myopic behavior. But when the reality intruded with subprime mortgages defaulting and sellers of credit default swaps being unable to meet their obligations, the bubble ultimately collapsed, taking with it the economy. The profits earned during this period proved to be illusionary, except for those market players who were highly compensated during the real estate bubble and for those institutions who got out of the relevant markets in time. The financial crisis has revealed informational and incentive problems in various markets, including bond and stock markets. Broadly speaking, the short-termism exhibited by this crisis is called earnings management, which consists of the rush to report earnings to create favorable market impressions that are divorced from reality. It is an attempt to have bond or stock prices reflect value that is, in fact, illusionary. Earnings management not only contributed to the recent financial crisis, but through the financial scandals of the early 2000s involving Enron, WorldCom, and other such companies. Two types of earnings management exist, are real earnings management and accounting earnings management. Real earnings management involves managers making choices that affect the real operations of their corporations, such as the decision to underwrite or buy subprime mortgage-backed securities, or to decrease R&D or marketing expenses to meet quarterly earnings targets. In contrast, accounting earnings management involves a manipulation of numbers or use of financial accounting vehicles to affect the reporting earnings of the company. This includes the use of off-balance sheet special purpose entities for disguising the company's ownership of risky mortgage-backed securities, or the increasing or decreasing of the level of accounting accruals, such as accounts receivable, inventories, accrued liabilities, and prepaid expenses to meet quarterly earnings targets. After the various financial scandals of the early 2000s, Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which is called SOX. Studies show that accrual earnings management decreased after the passage of SOX. However, the consequences of SOX is that accompanying a decrease in accrual earnings management was an increase in real earnings management. Obviously, this is an unintended consequence of SOX and a potentially serious one. Accrual accounting affects only the timing of earnings recognitions and does not alter either the amount or the temporal flow of true economic profits. Real earnings management, however, alters operational practices and thus diminishes true economic profits. This is not to say that SOX increased the likelihood of a financial crisis, but it has changed the practices of firms in their quest to meet quarterly earnings targets. An additional consequence of SOX is that earnings management is now more difficult to detect because accounting earnings management is often more easily detected than real earnings management. The recent financial crisis has demonstrated the dangers to firm performance of earnings management, as have recent studies. One recent study covered 6,642 companies from the period 1986 to 2005. The study identified potentially myopic firms as those firms with reported increased profitability at the same time that they decreased support for R&D and marketing. Contrary to the efficient market hypothesis, the study found that markets do not accurately value firms at the time that they engage in myopic behavior. The study also documented significant future negative returns for myopic firms. It found that the future adjusted stock returns for myopic firms were significantly less than for non-myopic firms, and that the magnitude of these negative returns increased over the four-year period of the study to as much as 16 to 21%. Finally, the study found that the initial benefit to shareholders of myopic firms, that is, the stock premiums earned by shareholders at the time of the myopic behavior, were outweighed by the underperformance of these firms in the following 4 years. The financial crisis in the study raises the question, if earnings management is not in the interest of firm shareholders, why do firm managers engage in it? This requires disregarding the faulty predictions of neoclassical economic theory in favor of game theory and behavioral economics. A number of explanations exist, and because of time constraints, I will only briefly discuss a few of them. First is the prisoner's dilemma. In the situation where managerial behavior is not observable by markets, managers are faced with a situation similar to the prisoner's dilemma. On the one hand, if shareholders expect myopic behavior that inflates the attractiveness of the firm's stock, the rational manager will engage in such behavior, or his firm will suffer in competition in the marketplace. On the other hand, even if the market does not expect myopic behavior, the manager will have an incentive to inflate the attractiveness of his firm's stock in anticipation that other firm managers may do so. Thus, the dominant strategy is for a manager who cares about stock price to engage in myopic decision-making. Citibank's former CEO, Charles Prince, reflected this logic with his famous claim that as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. He is claiming that to remain competitive during a bubble, it is rational to ignore fundamental value in favor of a short-term strategy. The famous economist John Maynard Keynes described this phenomenon in his well-known discussion of a beauty contest, in which contestants are required to choose the prettiest face among six faces. Those eligible for a prize are the contestants who pick the most popular face. The rational strategy for the contestant is not to pick the face that he views as the prettiest, but to pick the face that he believes others would think to be the prettiest, or one step removed, the face that everyone would believe everyone else would view to be the prettiest. Similarly, the decision-making strategy for Citibank, as indicated by his former CEO, would be based not on assessing the fundamental values of an investment, but on assessing what everyone else believes the value to be, and thus in the process enhancing Citibank's reported earnings. Another reason for short-termism is due to the underestimation of low-frequency economic shocks, resulting in what is called disaster myopia. Behavioral economics explain this phenomenon using the availability hypothesis. The hypothesis explains that individuals, even sophisticated statisticians, underestimate the likelihood of low-frequency economic shocks. Banks and accountants have recurring exposure to high-frequency events, such as defaults on car loans and credit card loans, and are able to make reasonable estimates of these events, which are reflected in periodic accounting statements. However, low-frequency events are less likely to get the attention of the decision-maker, giving rise to an availability bias. In addition, this problem is compounded by the threshold heuristic, whereby events whose likelihood falls below a threshold level are often disregarded altogether by busy decision makers. Numerous articles have criticized the myopic financial models used by the financial community, and this is one of one such criticism. Another explanation for short-termism, which is applicable to financial firms, is based on Hyman Minsky's financial instability theory. Minsky explained how structural biases in financial companies, companies that borrow to lend, lead them to ever-increasing levels of leverage during periods when the economy is strong and interest rates low, and that this leverage leads them to a state of financial fragility. During the recent real estate bubble, the leverage ratio of investment banks, for example, increased dramatically from 30 to 1 to 40 to 1, a 30% increase. Minsky's argument is as follows. As money is borrowed to invest in assets, asset prices rise, which has the effect of causing certain financial firms to borrow more. This increased borrowing results in firms either maintaining a targeted leverage or increasing their leverage level. One study has found that during bubbles, commercial banks, due to regulations, maintain a targeted leverage level, whereas investment banks, broker-dealers, increase their leverage level. In both cases, the amount of borrowing increases and the trend to more speculative debt occurs, from hedge to speculative to Ponzi debt. The financial firms use this borrowing to acquire increasingly valued assets and will continue to do so in a state of euphoric expectations that asset values will continue to increase. In addition to leverage, competition from investment firms may lead to short-termism in financial markets. The problem is that investors do not have perfect information about the ability of fund managers to invest their money. Consequently, investors who place their money in investment funds charge a higher cost of capital, that is, demand a higher return than if the information was readily available. In addition to demanding a higher cost of capital, investors often place their funds in financial firms, with notable exceptions, on a short-term basis. For example, investors can readily withdraw their funds from open-ended mutual funds. Private and public pension fund overseers can readily change fund managers. And the troublesome run on the bank is possible because of the existence of demand deposits. The higher cost of capital and the ability of investors to readily change fund managers make trading in short-term assets more attractive to fund managers than in long-term assets. The explanation for this is as follows. Fund managers make their money by identifying instances of mispricing. They assume dual risks, the risk that the fundamental value of the asset may fall before the mispricing is eliminated. That's a fundamental risk. And the risk that mispricing may get worse before it is eliminated, called noise trade risk, at a point when the trade must be liquidated. These risks are greater for long-term asset arbitrage because there is more time for bad news or a wave of pessimism to hit. It is therefore less risky and less costly for fund managers to arbitrage a short-term asset for which mispricing will disappear in the short term than a long-term asset for which mispricing will not disappear for some time. In addition to economic reasons for short-termism, of which I've briefly discussed just a few of them, there are also cultural reasons for short-termism. But at this point, I would like to address what should be done about it. A multifaceted approach is necessary. Looking at such issues as shareholder voting rights, fiduciary duties of directors and fund managers, disclosures, compensation policies, capital and margin requirements, tender offer regulation, and stakeholder governance, as well as tax changes. So it's a fairly broad, if we are going to deal with this issue of short-termism, we have to attack it from a number of different perspectives. I thought I would share some interesting research that relates to Bill Bratton's presentation, which deals with the shareholder voting aspect of a change that we might want to make. And I'd like to share with you some research that I found on this subject. I found research that supports the finding that the presence of institutional ownership of firms is actually negatively associated with managerial myopia, and therefore supports those who believe that institutional shareholders are a positive force for managerial accountability. This finding supports, for example, recent proposals by the SEC and in Congress to provide shareholder access to the proxy statements of public companies to nominate a minority of directors to boards of directors. So this might be part of the contrary argument. There is a burgeoning literature about institutional shareholders that differentiate among these shareholders by taking into account the characteristics of portfolios in which their stock are invested. That is, rather than categorizing institutional investors by legal categories such as mutual funds or banks or insurance companies or whatever, this looks at the characteristics of portfolios of these companies and considers, for example, one factor, portfolio stock turnover rates. And the scheme involves classifying institutional investors as transient, dedicated, or quasi-indexers. These studies find that although institutional investor ownership is negatively associated with managerial myopia, that if you look just at the transient institutional ownership, that is in fact positively associated with myopia and short-termism. And those were the kinds of things that I think Bill was focusing on in his talk. Transient institutional shareholders have short-term time horizons reflected in high portfolio turnovers, high use of momentum trading, and high diversification, highly diversified portfolios. While these firms may hold a quarter of their portfolio for 2 years, they pursue aggressive trading strategies with often over 70% of their portfolio's turnover each quarter. And a suggestion for countering short-termism is to restrict the voting rights of this particular class of shareholders. The evidence on transient institutional investors indicates that support of short-termism, and this evidence is consistent across studies. Studies show that a high level of transient institutional ownership is associated with an overweighing of near-term earnings. In addition, a sharper drop in stock price on the release of disappointing earnings news is found in firms with higher transient institutional ownership. Firms with a shareholder base dominated by transient institutional shareholders are also more likely to cut research and development expenses, that is, engage in real earnings management, to meet short-term earnings targets than firms that are dominated by dedicated and quasi-indexer institutional shareholders. Transient ownership is also positively related to the magnitude of accruals, that is, accounting earnings management, whereas dedicated and quasi-indexer ownership is negatively associated with the magnitude of accruals. In addition, transient ownership was found to be positively associated with the likelihood and magnitude of financial restatements or misreporting, but no association was found with dedicated and quasi-indexer institutional shareholders. Finally, a higher percentage of transient institutional ownership is associated with an increased likelihood of the disclosure of internal control weaknesses, which weaknesses are negatively associated with future operating performance and stock returns. It is also interesting to note that high institutional holding of independent long-term institutional shareholders with larger stakes are positively associated with post-merger performance, and firms with such holdings are more likely to announce the withdrawal of announcements of the worst deals. In addition, the significant presence of transient ownership is associated with an increased likelihood of takeovers, but also with overbidding and value-reducing acquisitions. What this means is that while commentators have argued for limiting or eliminating altogether voting by institutional investors because of concern for short-termism, it may be more appropriate to categorize institutional investors by portfolio characteristics and impose restrictions only on the transient and institutional investors. And the further research I am doing may indicate the need to, you know, modify the definition of transient institutional investors. In conclusion, overall, there are economic and cultural reasons for short-termism, which is detrimental to the economy. To counter short-termism, a multifaceted approach, of which just talking about shareholder voting indicates how we might proceed in that regard, is necessary to change business and investment norms and regulations, and then the process to counter pressures for short-termism. I might also say that there are some dangers in not allowing shareholders to elect a minority of directors to the board of directors, which is the proposal that that has been made. There is a huge literature on the advantage of having diversity of perspective on corporate boards of directors, so that's certainly something that I've written about and that we might think about. In addition, a lot of the improvements in boards of directors have been caused by the activism of shareholders. And so I don't think we want to put all shareholders in one basket. And I would agree with Bill that there's a lot of bad things being done. I think the transient shareholder definition may be sufficient to cover the concerns of the repurchases and of stock that has been occurring, and also if you look at what some of these activists want to do, it's generally liquidate the company, sell the company, but then there are all of these other shareholder proposals that I think are much more positive, and I could actually use some help on this, but the interesting thing would be to try to categorize some of these activists according to this classification scheme that that I propose. The last thing I would say is that if you disempower shareholders, who do you have? Who do you have to make managers accountable? And there I have some suggestions that relate to stakeholder theory. And so I think maybe that's a direction we should go in. But at this point, to simply write the shareholders out, I think it was definitely not a way I would go in that regard. Okay.